Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and this is Bonnie Kay, and welcome to the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my guests and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. If you have any comments you'd like to make during this broadcast, you can either call them in at area code 646-716-4893, or if you're radio shy, you can email me at bonkay@aol.com. That's B-O-N-K-A-Y-E @aol.com. Before I introduce my wonderful guests for tonight, I just want to remind people that the summer is flying by, and I'm getting ready for our California retreat in September. I know it's only weeks away before a whole bunch of us will be converging on Los Angeles to have our healing weekend. I'm really excited about this prospect of meeting women from all over the country and outside the country who are coming here, and to help each other in our efforts to heal along this road, because it certainly is a long and winding road that takes you back and forth many times till you get to the end. But through having support and by listening to others who are kind of veterans now and seeing how they healed and listening to their stories and also the problems and the trials and tribulations, we all feel very uniquely bonded together, and that you'll have a new family, new people to talk to, and you won't feel alone in your journey. So if you're interested in joining me, please go to my website at gayhusbands.com and click into the information with about the retreat, or you can just write to me directly at bonkay@aol.com. We are staying 5 minutes from the airport. There's a shuttle bus right there for people coming in from out of town. We have a group rate. It's going to be a great weekend. And, well, you have to pay for your expenses to get there and one dinner, and the rest is a gift from me. So if you would like to join me, there's still time, and I'd be very happy to meet you and give you that big hug in person. So tonight, without further ado, I'm going to introduce my guest, who has been with us several times before, and it's such a treat when she does come, Ms. Alexa Servadidio, who is a licensed clinical social worker in New York. She also has her own radio show, Insight into Healing, where she helps people heal from personal pain with their and grow, with helping them with their personal growth. She does psychotherapy at a large mental health clinic in New York and has her own private practice in Mamaroneck, New York. So I want to welcome you back, Alexa. It's such a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much, and it's such a pleasure to come back. Thank you so much. I love being on your show.
Oh, thank you, and I love listening to your shows because they're just so informative. In fact, before we even get started, maybe you can tell people how they can get to your – what's the best way to get information? Would you say your Facebook page is the best way?
Yes, I have a Facebook page, Insight into Healing, or you can always send me an email at insightintohealing@gmail.com. And I post questions or, you know, ideas for topics, and all names remain confidential. So those are the best two ways to get in contact with me.
You know, you're such a great find for us, and I know that people feel inspired when you talk. Unfortunately, we can't all live in your neighborhood, or I'd be coming to you myself. But
Thank you. In the meantime,
you do work with individuals, couples, and families, and work with them on a lot of issues, but specifically you really specialize in healing when it comes to anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress that comes about from divorce, you know, also a lot with domestic violence, sexual abuse, and trauma, which I think that all of our women go through some aspect of this. So if you do live in the New York area or Westchester area, this is the woman you want to see in order to heal with your therapy. And also you've done a lot of work with child sexual abuse, is that right?
Yes, yes. I was actually interviewed for an article that was in the Journal News on child sexual abuse at the Hackley School. And I've worked with a lot of children, and I still do, that have had sexual abuse, and also adults who were abused as children. So a lot of trauma, a lot of sexual trauma, physical trauma, emotional, all interconnected.
Mm-hmm. In fact, that makes me just ask you one question, because we've had several women in our group who, on top of all the, you know, ordinary trauma that we all go through with this particular situation, have also had husbands who were into pedophilia and have to keep their children safe or grandchildren safe. Would you be able to work with those women as well?
Yes, yes. I've worked with women who's had spouses or significant others that were exposed to that they had found out later on or during the marriage that there was some indication that was something that could have been going on. But yes.
You know, it's an interesting thing that you just brought that up, and I'd just like to have your opinion, because as wives of gay men, you know, sometimes it's really difficult to realize there's a separation in communities and thinking between the straight community and the gay male community. And in many cases, women are very shocked when they find their husbands with younger men, and sometimes young men. What's the age limit, would you say, that would constitute something that's really inappropriate if your husband was involved with a young man? How young is inappropriate?
I would say, you know, but even if it was heterosexual, anything under 18 years old was definitely inappropriate, which I find, you know, it's a crime to be with anyone younger than 18 years old. And I, you know, it's been coming a lot of time, you know, older men sometimes, even if they go into, you know, they're going into the midlife crisis, but sometimes they go a few years younger or 10, 15 years younger. But I find definitely anything under 18 years old is definitely inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
To be having any type, even, you know, even if there's not any sexual, you know, contact going on, any emotional contact, any, you know, via social media or text messaging, sexting, or any of that is very inappropriate and illegal to be doing. But it's very, unfortunately, it's on the rise because of, you know, how social media is growing and you can contact anybody on all these different sites. And I find that it's becoming such a huge crisis an epidemic that a lot of these younger people, the underage people, have no idea really what they're getting into. And, you know, a lot of sexual predators, what they do is they groom their victims from a young age. So they groom them so they'll do what they, you know, what they want to do. And it's you know, it's like brainwashing. And it just, you know, it could start off just with some text messages or some instant messaging, chatting, what do you do, what's your favorite ice cream, what's your favorite sport, and then leading, you know, gaining trust and then leading into this becoming sexually inappropriate. And when someone's underage and, you know, not emotionally mature, they don't see this happening. They don't see this becoming inappropriate. They might have a little, you know, tinge in their stomach like, that seems a little different. But, you know, they say, oh, this person seems like a good person. I've built this trust with them. And they fall victim to it. But it's called the grooming process. They do this. And there was a study that they said a sexual predator can come to a classroom of 20 students and pick and kind of see which students he knows he can you know, groom and sexually act out with that won't tell on him just by certain mannerisms. They know, you know, if they come from a vulnerable home, if there's abuse in their home, if they have low self-confidence or parents that not are around, that predators are so, you know, manipulative like that. They know how to read, you know, the signs of these younger children, these young adults who they can, you know, take as prey.
And I think I'd like to also mention, and you could reconfirm this too, that a lot of women have this terrible fear that gay pedophile is equal, and I like to always stress one thing has absolutely nothing to do with the other. So there are many gay men who are very opposed to any kind of pedophilia and who would feel just as sickened by it as a straight person would. But I think they get this concept because many times the gay community seems so sexually oriented, and many of their husbands end up with young lovers who aren't much older than their own children. And that's not to say they couldn't be over 18, but they still feel it's inappropriate when you have somebody who's 18 or 19 and you have children who are 15 or 16. What are your feelings on that?
Oh, yes. I don't agree at all that gay, you know, being gay and pedophilia have anything to do with each other. They're two separate things. I think just because, you know, you're homosexual, that means you're, you know, has anything to do with pedophilia. I don't agree with that at all. And I actually did a show and was working with people who their specialty is working with young boys that sexually act out on other young children. And I said, does that, you know, what about the, a lot of parents were nervous that they had like a young son and maybe they were, you know, sexually acting out with another young boy that they were friends with. And they said, does this mean that my son is homosexual? And they said, no, it had nothing to do with it. That doesn't define it. So, you know, I don't. You know, I know sometimes when you find out these things and it's such a shock and a trauma to find out that your significant other is homosexual, is gay, that you start thinking, your mind starts racing to all different scenarios. So it can be very, very overwhelming. And I think it's kind of taking a step back and saying, okay, let me just get the real picture of what's going on and the reality of it.
I think one of the problems is that pedophiles, of course, you know, as horrible as they are, when you see all these sensationalized stories like priests with boys in the church, and when you see stories like Jerry Sandusky at Penn State with young boys, yes, that the first thing that goes through your mind, because they're having relationships with males, is that gay and pedophile equal the same. And I'm very, very clear on that one thing has absolutely nothing to do with the other. That there are pedophiles that like little girls. There are pedophiles that like little boys or who like both. They just want the easy access.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they necessarily would stick with boys if they had a girl handy.
Yes, I think it's about opportunity. Who's, you know, who's easy access and opportunity and who they can get away with.
Exactly. And I think that it's a matter of power and control over a child. And although, quite frankly, although I don't think I could ever understand it, and I've tried for many years, I just don't get it. But I don't even know if anybody can get it, right? It's just so foreign.
I think it's a sick. It's a sickness. It's a serious sickness, distortion of reality.
And I don't think anybody's had real success in trying to. And I think this is one illness they say that can never be cured.
Yes, I don't. I've never really met anyone or worked with anyone who's come out of it, who's cured, who's, you know, I've had that known people, worked with people who have curtailed and acting out their behavior. But it's an ongoing process. I mean, it's something, not that pedophilia has anything to do with, you know, alcoholism or a drug addiction, but it's something to do with, it's an addiction. It's a lifestyle. It's something you have to every day work on. You can't let it slip or you might relapse. It's a tough thing. It's an everyday struggle.
And I think that many people just don't want to fight that battle. You know, they're comfortable at that comfort level. So that's why it is so serious. And, you know, it's just so tragic. But once again, I like to reassure people that it has nothing to do with homosexuality. Because, you know, it doesn't matter if you're straight or gay. There are plenty of straight predators also, which is why I tell women they have to really rebuild themselves before they're ready for another relationship, because you're so vulnerable when you go out there and meet men who are predators. And just like you were saying, how these predators can go into a classroom and pick out who their victims will be, I think it doesn't change as you get older. The predators may get a little older and looking for a woman, but they're still looking for that same woman that they were looking for in that little girl. Wouldn't you say so?
Yes, and unfortunately they're getting better at their searches and they're fine-tuning their manipulation. You know, it's like the more they practice, the more women that they've been manipulating, they read different signs how they can, you know, control, manipulate, you know, put down to gain control over that woman. I think that's what's really, you know, as women get older that have been through this, it's kind of not looking and blaming themselves, but to kind of step out of it and say, okay, what can I do? This happened. What can I do to try to prevent this from ever happening again?
And I think if we look at a broader picture here, we see a lot of women and men who become victims to predators on all different levels. And one of the things that you and I were discussing or talking about discussing were people who come from very controlling relationships. And this is such a wide range. It can start with something as a relationship and expand all the way into cults, because there are many women who are also very vulnerable to going into cults, and men also who, you know, fall into this trap of falling for a very charismatic people. And I know that Donna Anderson does a lot of work with her predatory shows, but she also feels that, you know, there's a certain, you know, certain prototype of person that will come after you. And it doesn't matter if it's one-on-one or as a group, but these are people who are controlling people, who are using people for their own purposes. And I find that people have such a hard time recovering from this when they're under the control of someone, because first of all, you know, they have such a hard time understanding how do they ever fall into this. So do you have any insight on that?
Yes, I find it very interesting that I think a lot of people who have been victim to this, who have fallen prey to these cults, I would like to work with them and tell them that to try to watch not to get kind of stuck or caught up in that cycle of how did I get into this, why did I get into this. If you look at it as a positive level, like on a positive person that comes into your life, when people are younger and there's, you know, like the Beatles or there's a famous rock singer, people become enamored by them, or someone who's like a motivational speaker or an actor or a sports figure. Could you imagine that sports figure coming to their house and saying, hey, come to hang out with me, or come out to dinner with me, or I think you're really great, and this person really hasn't had any family support, has had a hard life, has, you know, no one's really showed them respect, doesn't have, you know, good self-esteem, and then this person that they admire or that they think is so powerful gives them attention. I mean, I would think anyone would say, wow, this person's paying attention to me. You're going in there with the best intentions. Do you think this person is really true and a good person? I think what it is, it's just such a shock to the core and just to your true being that I think when these victims fall prey to this, it's such a violation of every aspect of their mind, body, and soul that I think sometimes they can't even accept the fact that this happened, so they almost start turning on themselves and blaming themselves. And I would say try, I know it's easier said than done, but try to kind of get out of blaming yourself and judging yourself and saying, okay, how, you know, what happened, how did this happen, but how can I move forward and fill that void that this person supposedly came in that I thought was providing something for me. How can I make sure this doesn't happen again? And how can I kind of self-soothe myself so I can give myself that, you know, that peace or that comfort that I thought I was getting from this other person?
I know that a lot of times people, like you say, when you don't have the high self-esteem to start with, that it's so easy to have a predator come to you and shower you with love and tell you how wonderful you are. Because I always say that for the most part, predators don't, like even going into domestic violence, when you start dating somebody at the very beginning of a relationship where there's domestic violence, that person doesn't take you out on your first date and punch you in the face. I mean, that's not how it works. They have to first gain your trust. They have to first see how they can manipulate you around. You know, first they're going to have you fall really in love with them before they try anything. Do you find that happens a lot, too?
Yes, and it's such a manipulation, and it's so calculated, which I think is even more frightening when you think about this, that someone who's never been exposed to this type of evil or any type of anything, this behavior, why would they even think that this was going on? So I think that's why it becomes such a shock to the core, and to really say, you know, this other person who's this abuser, this cult leader, is so manipulative and so thought out that people get so taken advantage of. And it almost makes them start blaming themselves, and then society or other people saying, well, how could you fall for that? What's, you know, I thought you were smarter than that. I don't find it has anything to do with you could have been smarter, you could have done this. You know, it happened, and I think it's kind of saying, okay, what else is there going on, and how can I get out of this? But like being, you know, master manipulators, they want to manipulate you. That's their life. That's their job. They can find out what you want to hear, what your weaknesses are. It's a study. It's almost like, you know, preparing for a job interview or preparing for a triathlon or something. These manipulators, these people are, that's their premeditation of what they do. That's what, you know, what their basis is.
And I think a lot of predators, whether they're acting in a relationship, a cult or otherwise, have similar aspects to them where they try to isolate you from family and friends.
Yes.
Because the more you talk about them, and somebody might wake you up and say, what are you doing? So it's just easier. I know that I had that in my own marriage where my ex-husband would manipulate my family if he didn't want them around me so I could find comfort with them. You know, and I see this with a lot of our women, that they just make it so unpleasant for anybody to come by. They'll start arguments. They'll fight with you. They'll fight in front of them. And I think this is also a way of manipulating you so that you won't be able to have people around you. Am I seeing that the correct way?
Oh, yes. And I think isolation is a huge red flag when you're in a relationship or any type of environment. If someone is isolating you or trying to not let you see other people or saying, you know, your family's bad, don't listen to them, your friends are bad, it's all that. Because once you don't have that outside connection, they become your be-all. So you listen to everything they say, and after a while, even if you didn't believe it in the beginning, it's brainwashing. You keep hearing the same thing. You keep hearing you're worth nothing, you're stupid, you're this, you're that. You could be the strongest person in the world. It's when you're isolated like that and you don't see it, and you don't see it coming. You become a victim to it. You fall prey to it.
I know. When I was younger, a long time ago, before you were born, Alexa. I was involved in political activities back in the 70s, and one of the activities that we were doing, you know, we were fighting against cult groups at that point, where people would be joining these cult groups and their whole lives would be consumed with it, and they'd have to be selling flowers in the streets of New York and at the airports, and they were smart people who came out of colleges who all of a sudden were like zombies. And you had to wonder what would cause somebody to give up their life and give up their families. They weren't allowed to talk to their families anymore. And there were tens of thousands of them back in the 70s. And we would be involved in getting them kind of deprogrammed at that point. But it was like really a fascinating study of how the human mind would work. But sometimes they were able to get past it, and other times they wanted to go right back to it. And it's kind of like you were saying, that sometimes people can learn to love people who are abusing them. Is that part of it?
Yes. And, I mean, you can. And I work with a lot of women who have been with abusive and men who have been with abusive partners. And you still, you know, because I think when you're in love and emotions, they can be irrational. And it takes a long time for the mind and the heart to catch up with each other. But it can be possible that you still love this person. And I think that's how sometimes people can get taken advantage by these cults and stuff. Everyone wants something to believe in, something to love, something to be passionate about. And I think a lot of times, as you said in the beginning, they're on their best behavior. You're thinking, wow, where did this come from? This is the best thing going on. How come I didn't know about this? And they're supportive, and you're getting all your needs met. So then once they get you in there, they start slowly seeing how far they can push you and test you, what your boundaries are, what your limits are, and they start breaking into it and start kind of breaking you down and start breaking down your whole system, your whole belief system, your family system, your support system, and everything you've ever believed in. And then you become just, you know, a zombie to them and everything that they say and their power and control.
It kind of reminds me of back in those days, maybe you've read about the Manson family.
Yes,
cult.
Yes.
And I remember very well when that went on. And, of course, the two women who were involved with this, every couple of years I see they're on television looking to see if they can get parole because they've been in prison since the 1970s, and now they've become social workers and they help everyone. And they claim that what they did then was a momentary craziness and that they're totally different people now. But I think that to go to the extremes that people were going through back then, where you were literally taking people and just knifing them and killing them for no reason, like with Sharon Tate, she was pregnant, having a baby, killing Sharon Tate and her baby. I mean, do people really ever outgrow that? Is that a temporary insanity, or what do you think?
My professional view, I think temporary insanity or something that could be somewhat understandable is a crime of passion, or saying, okay, this is something you can probably go through lots of therapy and help and really work on it for many, many, many years. But the idea of, you know, to have the ability to go and stab someone, take out a baby, and really violently hurt people and do that is a sign of something else. I mean, they also say when I work with young children, three things to really look for if this child is going to be a sociopath or something is fire setting, abusing animals, and a lot of bedwetting. Those three things are three huge factors. I mean, I think it takes a certain type of person to hurt an animal, to hurt another person, to have that rage enough, and to follow people and saying that this is okay for you to take somebody else's life. I think that's something totally different than, you know, a temporary mind lapse or something that happened. I think that's something, you know, there was a lot of brainwashing going on, but I think there's also some severe condition or personality disorder or major mental illness that accompanies that.
I mean, I can understand their argument that they changed, but I still feel people need to get punished for the crime. So sometimes it's really difficult because I'm a humanist first, and that's not always working to somebody's advantage, not to anybody's advantage, really. But on the other hand, I really do feel that people do have to pay a penalty for what they do, even though I feel sorry they were only 17 or 18 when they did it, or 18 or 19. But you make mistakes, and you have to pay for them for many years to come.
Mm-hmm.
But when you were talking about before about sociopaths, since you've done so much work in this field, and so many of us are involved with people who have sociopathic behavior, in your opinion, is this a nature versus nurture? How do you view it?
I think a lot of it does have to come from the environment of where the person was brought up in, the family. I mean, sometimes there's been children that have grown up just that have had a good family. Things have been pretty good. There was nothing traumatic that has turned into a sociopath. But my work that I've worked with, I've found a lot of abuse going on, or there was a lot of addiction in the house, or mom and dad weren't present. Maybe they were a lot in the foster care system. They were living on the streets, or you know, really just a lack of attachment and a lack of anyone teaching them compassion, empathy, any type of bond, because I find children really need to bond, you know, in those early years with their parents, and they feel they have a safe environment, they can explore who they are and grow and be encouraged to grow. And when children don't have that environment, they either learn to become too needy, and they'll just grab anything that comes near them, and they just want anybody to love them, or they kind of learn to shut down. You know, they say that there are different studies with babies that mom never comes when they cry. And if after so many months, mom doesn't really pay attention to them when they're crying, as they grow up, they realize they have to self-soothe themselves in a negative kind of way, and they kind of cut themselves off. So they kind of they weren't taught that bonding, that empathy, that, you know, attachment with a loved one. And I don't know, if you don't really learn that as a young age, or someone really doesn't show you how that, or kind of role model or give you that example, how to love, how to be attached to someone, how to be encouraged, how do you find that? I mean, there's some people I've worked with that are so resilient. They've learned it somehow by a teacher, by a priest in church, or by a family friend or a neighbor or somebody that showed them extra care, showed them love, or, you know, tried to give them guidance, which gave them some positive growth in the right direction. But I find usually it's the environment, trauma, substance abuse, lack of parental care that really helps, you know, formulate these, you know, kind of grow these sociopaths, the breeding ground.
Do you think people are predisposed to this or no?
I'm not sure. I know I'm kind of going, I've been really studying that and reading about it, and I'm split down the middle about which way to really go with it, but I'm not sure. I feel, you know, really the environment and family has a lot to do with it, but I'm not really sure yet. I'm still researching about it.
Yes, because I'm really interested in that particular topic for, you know, some personal reasons, and I've done a lot of looking into this also, but I still feel that sometimes it can be predisposed or genetically built in. And I think, like many other things, that if it's there, you know, depending on what direction you go in life, you're much more apt to be like that. I mean, even if you come from a loving environment, you can still sometimes, you know, when you see cases where you have two brothers who grew up in very similar situations with parents, and one becomes, you know, the good guy, the other becomes, you know, violent criminal, why would one go one way, one go the other way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it also brings up, you know, if there's a medical history of cancer or diabetes in your family, doctors say you have a higher chance of, you know, having that. Even if you, you know, you eat healthy, you're skinny, you don't smoke, you don't, you know, there's still a chance you can never have smoked and got lung cancer. There's different things. So I think there's some truth to it. There's some science to it that I think there you can have some predisposition, something in your in different generations. If there was mental illness, usually there's some, you know, there's some genetics going down with, if there's been mental illness in
exactly.
your family.
Exactly. I think that's also genetically proven that, you know, it is kind of inherited when it comes to mental illness. So that's what I was thinking about, you know, sociopaths. That maybe it's something that is kind of genetically predisposed, and given the right circumstances, those issues can come up. With sociopaths, do they have to totally be a sociopath, or can there be a mixture?
I think they're, you know, sometimes the sociopaths that I've found is that they really don't have any regard or feel feelings of regret, of sympathy for others.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know if someone really works hard with them and kind of teaches them some way after many, many, many years of work, can kind of teach them somehow some to have compassion. I mean, I think any human, it's possible that miracles happen. People can maybe learn how to be compassionate and learn to be a good person. But I think it's usually, you know, if they have no regard for humans, or they don't feel any sorrow or sadness or regret, that is something I feel they can never really come out of, especially on their own, and especially if they don't acknowledge it. If this person is aware and says, wow, I'm a, which maybe once in a while there is somebody who's aware of that, But I find sometimes they don't even have the awareness that they're doing anything wrong. They don't take any responsibility for their behavior. It's always somebody else. It's their fault you made me do it.
So do you think that there's any methodology? I mean, can sociopaths change?
I think there's some success rate. If there's a lot of therapy and treatment and rehabilitation, but I think it's a lot of work. But again, if the person has no awareness or any wanting to change or even want to work on it, which they usually don't, I think it's almost impossible.
Yes, I don't see too much change. First of all, I don't think they even recognize their behaviors, and I think a sociopath, in most cases, they don't really care because they don't have the empathy to care to start with, so they don't feel that need to change. Do you find that this is tied in with narcissism at all?
Yes, I think there is some, definitely there's a narcissistic aspect to it, that, you know, it's all about me, I'm the one, and very grandiose thoughts that they're better than everybody else, and also those usually narcissistic people are very insecure too, so they have a lot to lose emotionally if someone rejects them, so they're out to reject and, you know, hurt them before they hurt me. So I think that's what, you know, it's a healthy thing to, as a healthy person, to want to protect yourself from getting hurt. But I think someone with narcissism, I think would hurt someone first before, even if that person wasn't trying to hurt them. It's almost as a way of control, as a way of putting you down, of, you know, of that whole, you know, emotional, verbal abuse, of physical abuse, of they'll get their power and be on top no matter what the cost is.
It's funny you should say that, because I just got in an email and it said, can you ask Alexa why my husband loved me so much in the beginning, but turned into a hurtful, harmful man later in our marriage, showing me nothing but contempt?
Yes, and I think it, I say this to a lot of the women that I work with, and it's not to take it personal, even though it is, you know, I know this is your relationship, it's hard not to take it personal, but a lot of this has to do with them and their self-loathing and their self-hate, and I think they try to love, they try to not be the person they know down deep that's something that they are. And they try to really be, you know, that person. And after a while, the hate and the self-loathing and the resentment build so much, and they turn into, or they've always been that kind of abusive person. But through the years, abusers will show more. As in the beginning, they're always, you know, when it's good, it's good. But when it's bad, it's bad. And I think that's part of the cycle. And that's very common in abusive relationships. And I think that's what confuses the victim so much, because they're like, but he really, really loved me in the beginning. I mean, I was everything to him, and now, like, 2 years later, I can't even, you know, make breakfast the right way. I'm such a horrible person. And then that's the way of the control and the manipulation. You start looking at yourself saying, oh, my God, what did I do? Maybe did I gain weight? Am I not dressing the right way? Maybe he's with somebody else. And I think it's looking at, no matter what is going on, no matter what, you know, you burned dinner, you're not a good cook, or you gained so much weight, no one should be speaking to you like that. No one should be treating you. This is about them. This is something they have to work on. This is their own insecurity. And I think that's what I try to work with a lot of my women and a lot of the victims of these type of abuse is, you know, this is about them. This is their hate and their insecurity. And it's so hard when you're in love with someone or you're with somebody who's that abusive, because it's such a manipulation. They don't know what's going on themselves, and then you don't know what's going on, and then you're the kind of, you're like the verbal, physical punching bag for them.
And I think that in a lot of times our women really take the blame for things they shouldn't be even thinking to take the blame. But they feel as if they are the failures because the relationship is not working.
Yes. I see that so much with a lot of the people I work with. And it's, you know, and I think if there was a third person, outside person standing there and hearing what they were saying, it's, you know, anyone would tell them, you know, hey, what are you talking about? How could this, you can't make this person behave like that. And it's, you know, it's that blame, but that's what kind of perpetuates the abuse. Because then the abuser kind of confirms in the abuser's head, yes, it's your fault, and then you're so busy kind of trying to figure out what's wrong with you, and the abuse is just going on and getting worse and worse because it always escalates. You know, abusers always escalate. It doesn't, usually gets worse and worse through time. And I think it's really just saying, and it's hard, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of, acknowledgement and working on yourself and building strength to say, I don't deserve under what any circumstances to be spoken to like this or to be treated like this.
Let me ask you this question, Alexa. Women have such a hard time forgiving themselves. After these relationships are over, I think they have a harder time forgiving themselves than anybody else. Why did I allow this to happen? Why did I stay so long? How did I let him, put me around like this? What do you tell them?
Half the work is learning to forgive yourself. Because I find if you don't forgive yourself subconsciously, consciously, you're allowing somebody else to come in and punish you. It's almost saying that you're punishing yourself. And I think by forgiving yourself, we don't have control over what other people do. And yes, you've stayed in an abusive relationship, but that's part of what an abusive relationship, they keep you isolated. They keep you under control. And I think it takes all the attention off of the abuser, and it goes on to the victim, like, why would you do this? How could you stay in this? What's wrong with you? Instead of saying, this person abused me. Let's look at this person and not kind of point the finger at the victim. And I think that's what society jumps so quickly to say, well, what's wrong with you? Why would you stay? And it angers me so many times when I hear people say, well, I guess she likes to get hit because that's why she stays.
Exactly.
And it angers me so much when people say that has nothing to do with why that person is staying. It's so many layers of abuse and everything that has nothing to do with that.
I know. And sometimes I get angry at myself for thinking that too. More so when there are children involved and they're at risk. And I think that should have to be your priority, is taking care of those children. Letting them get abused and physically abused and emotionally abused is really hurting them. So sometimes I do try to be compassionate and understanding, and I know there's so many different things, but when it comes to having children, I think their needs always need to be put first.
Yes. Yes, I agree with the children. You have to leave when that type of abuse is going on with the children, or have the children taken out of the situation. And a lot of people say, oh, I don't want to do that because, children that grow up in a without two parents in the home, there's studies that show that they can get into more trouble or this and that. Well, there's a lot of studies that show if they're sitting there watching their parents abuse each other, is a lot more damage than saying, Daddy's not very healthy right now. We're going to live in our own house, and teaching them boundaries and what you don't have to put up with.
That was the next thing I was going to ask you, because I do have women who say, in fact, I have a man right now who's been in touch with me for, the last few weeks, and he really needs to leave that marriage. He's a gay man. He has a lover on the side. He was honest with his wife because I really pushed him to be honest. And, of course, they come from a religious family, and she's very upset, and she wants a 5-year commitment from him, at least until the kids grow up. And I said, well, that's going to be so detrimental because you don't want to be there to start with. Secondly, you can't live under her terms. She's saying, well, religious-wise, that he's going to go to hell and this and that, and if he leaves. But on the other hand, I said to him, it's not healthy if you're not happy being there and you're taking it out on your children.
Yes.
It's better to have a loving, stable relationship outside of that than to have a miserable one inside. But women
and
tell me a lot of times they're afraid to leave. They say that it's not going to be healthy for the kids. Okay, so living in hell is healthy? I don't get it.
And I think people almost are in denial, thinking the children don't know. They have no idea what's going on. You'll be amazed. I've had 5-year-olds come in, and I thought I was speaking to an adult. They know. They repeat exactly what they heard mom and dad say, that mom and dad thought they were whispering, and the kids went to bed, and just repeated things that no child should ever repeat. And they haven't even told their parents what they heard, and they're kind of thinking it's all their fault, and they hear the fighting. And, you know, children sense it. I find it's better to, you know, be honest with your children and say, listen, you know, we've got to separate for a while. It's not healthy. You know, we've got some things to work on, than to kind of have your child witness and expose and even know that those type of situations happen.
I know, and it's really sad because for some of our women, I do feel so bad because when they leave, the children don't understand it. Like they'll say to their moms, well, there's nothing wrong with, you know, having our dad being gay. You know, you're homophobic. You know, you hate gay people. And the mother will try to explain it has nothing to do with that. You know, it's the fact that it's not right for the marriage. And I think somehow the children really sometimes turn on their mothers, and they don't want to hear it. You know,
yes.
They love their daddies. They feel their mommies are responsible for getting rid of their dad, so they hold the mother responsible.
Yeah, and I think most children believe that they want their parents, they want their parents no matter what to always stay together and be in love and, you know, don't worry, our parents can get through everything, they can make it through everything. But I think as an adult to say, you know, yeah, but we're still for your parents, we're still a family, but it's, you know, certain things that can't be.
I know. There's just no easy answers to any of this. But I do say that living in a marriage that's so filled with any kind of abuse, whether it's emotional, physical, any kind of abuse is more destructive than living separately. I just think that some women are so beaten down from living like this for so long, they're just so scared of everything. I know I was scared, you know, and I wasn't even married as long as most of my women were. But I know that when my ex-husband used to say to me, you're never going to be able to make it on your own. You're never going to be able to be a mother to these children by yourself. You're not capable, you know, because I kept hearing all these negative messages. And I think that kept me there longer than I wanted to be there because I started to believe them. And don't you think that happens a lot when you live with someone who's emotionally abusive? You start eventually thinking maybe that person's right?
Oh, yes. And I think that's what abuse does. It makes you question yourself and doubt everything about yourself. And it's a slow process. It doesn't happen overnight. So sometimes, a lot of times, you don't really realize it's happening until it's too late. You've lost because you question yourself all the time. And I think that's what happens. And then you don't even know, should I leave? Is it me? What's going on? And I think you're just so beaten down. You don't, you know, when someone keeps saying something over and over and over again, it plants seeds in your head.
Seeds of fear and seeds of insecurity that you're not able to do it. And I don't think it takes a long time of battering, because I know that I was a very strong woman when I got married. But I just married a man who was a bully, and so it didn't take long for me to get beaten down and to start believing all, you know, at least some of the messages he was giving me. And you do start doubting yourself, and you do start thinking, well, maybe there is something wrong with me, and maybe I'm not the best mother, maybe I'm not the best wife, you know, and this is how these guys get you where they want you.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Self-doubt becomes part of your everyday life.
Yeah, and you know, you loved this person. You trusted this person is your husband. You expect what they say. And I think if you didn't expect, you know, usually if this person was pretty good judge of character and then this abuse starts or the bullying starts to really escalate, you do think it's yourself for a while. You're like, wow, where did that come from? Is that true? Did I really, you know, maybe it is me. And if you don't have a strong sense of self as it is, they can do that within one or two arguments. They can have you believing anything.
Exactly. And could you explain a little bit to women about what passive-aggressive behavior is?
Well, there's different ways. It's not outwardly something so obvious where you can say, okay, that was really bad. That was wrong what he did or she did. It's you're really not sure exactly what passive-aggressive is. Would it be maybe, you know, like some sort of example if, you know, every morning when you go to work, you make sure you leave your keys by the front door so you know exactly where your keys are so you can just run out the door so you won't be late for work. Someone passive-aggressive might move the keys and put them in the kitchen or move the keys or put them somewhere else or maybe leave a shoe in the way. Maybe you'll trip or, you know, something, small things that you could say, oh, you know, maybe that could have been an accident. Okay, you know, that's not such a big deal. And I think it builds passively, but it's still aggressive and wrong behavior. And I think it can get bigger and bigger. It's not as obvious as an outward action or an outward statement or an intention. You start second guessing, and I think that's where people start. A lot of times I have women come in and say, am I crazy? And, you know, this person, they have caught this person on the internet chatting, has a fake profile, and is chatting with other people with, you know, sexual comments. And she said, but, you know, do you think he's really cheating? Maybe he's not him, but he has his own profile. But, she, I mean, it's, for anyone on the outside would see this and say, oh, my God, he has a profile on, you know, a dating site. That's cheating. What's he doing? He's a married man. But I think it's been so beaten down, and this person is questioning themselves so much that they don't know what the reality is anymore. They can't see what, you know, the person will say, oh, well, you're crazy. There you go again, making up stories. You need to get help. You know, you're hallucinating. And then the person's asking, maybe I am hallucinating. I mean, it's just this whole vicious cycle.
I know, and I think it's just another form of abuse, right?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Definitely.
I mean, it may not be as overt as, you know, direct emotional abuse or battering down, but it definitely is a sign of abuse and control.
Yeah.
Just not in as loud or volatile a way, but it's in a same way, but it still is.
Yes,
so,
I've had a lot of women say that have been in physical abusive relationships and emotional abusive relationships, that at least in the physical, the scars, the visible scars will heal, but with the emotional, they stick around a lot longer because he's really done damage to the inner being, to the inner self. Because he already put those words in your head or those thoughts that you're not good enough and the belief in those distorted beliefs.
So how do you get past this? You know, you're the therapist that does healing. When someone can't even forgive themselves, I mean, do they have to forgive the person victimizing them? Is that absolutely necessary? I always feel that, you know, forgiveness is something that needs to be earned, and I talk to people about learning about acceptance instead. But other people feel strongly about forgiving. I guess it's all what you can live with. How do you feel?
I don't think it's about, you know, actually forgiving, and I think it's what the actual forgiveness saying, okay, I'm not that I'm okay with it, but I'm over it. I think it's trying to figure out what is forgiveness for them, what is closure, and it's about the victim. I've worked with people who have been sexually abused by a family member, but they have to see this person at events or different things, and it's hard to kind of for them to kind of move forward. And I said, you know, would it be writing a letter to them and not mailing it? You know what? And it takes a couple of years. It took this one client a couple of years to really process what it is. You know, what is your closure? And I think for each person, what their closure is
mm-hmm.
what it's about. And it might just be not that you forgive, but you've let them go and you've let them not have space, that space in your mind anymore, and that space in your heart and your emotions. You're able to kind of say, you know, what you've done is wrong, but I'm going to let go of you for me.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I'm letting you off the hook saying it's okay. I'm saying I can't allow you to, you know, have this space in my life anymore. And whatever I feel, is it writing you a letter? Is it telling, you know, having, you know, speaking to that person, telling them how you feel? It's, you know, depending on each person, what is right, what feels right. I think it's really what this person needs to do is work on it. And it takes time to figure it out, and it can't be forced. But I think you'll be sitting with it and just finding closure and also working with how hard is it to find closure and how, you know, that the time in between as you're working through this and just being able to kind of sit with it and not have a definite answer on what the time limit is.
I know that for some people they feel that if you can't forgive, then it's your issue. But I really still feel, I like what you're saying, that you don't really need forgiveness, you need closure. And however you get that closure could be different from person to person. It's not going to be the same way for each person. I don't know how a person gets closure when it comes to sexual abuse, to be honest with you. I don't think I could really deal with, you know, knowing a relative who had molested me when I was 8 years old and hurt me back then. I don't know if I could ever really ever have to face that person wanting to kill him, you know, I'm being honest.
I know.
I'm not really good at that kind of stuff.
I think it's tough, and it's things that, you know, a lot of people say, how can you work with this? This is so hard to sit with it. But I think just being able to sit with this horrible act that happened, and for somebody else to hold it in the room with you, and to know that we don't have an exact answer, is so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives, you know, and really just power. It's really about empowering the person and taking their power back. That they're not this victim. They're not, you know, that they're, you know, and processing what happened.
Do you think
and
confronting
healing, and it takes time to heal.
How about confronting the predator? Does that help?
For some people, it can. Some
mm-hmm.
people have had it that it has worked. And some people have gotten great results. Some people have gotten horrible results. And I think that's something, too, that I do is I explore every option that we can do. And
mm-hmm.
we role play the best scenarios and we role play the worst scenarios that could happen. So
mm-hmm.
not that we know everything that's going to happen in the future, we can have an idea of how things could play out. So at least that person won't be shocked or won't be not prepared if the person said, you're lying, I never did this, you're crazy, you know, get away from me. At least we can prepare so then the person already has acted that out with me in session. So if the predator says that to them, they're able to kind of step back and say, okay, I've already had closure and I worked this out with my therapist. This
uh-huh.
is about me just coming out and saying what I have to say now. I don't have to negotiate with you or debate with you that you're wrong and I'm right. Because I think that's where the real more trauma happens and traumatic injury happens, when you're sitting there negotiating and fighting and trying to tell someone who did horrible things to you that it was them and not you, and then defend it and defend yourself, and then they kind of beat you down and abuse you and say horrible things. So it's really acting things out and working through it. And then I think even through sometimes role-playing and acting out in session,
uh-huh.
They get closure. I've had clients get closure there, and they're like, you know, no, I don't think I even really need to see this person right now. Maybe in a couple of years I might want to talk to them, but right now doing this here, I've gotten the closure that I've needed or some sort of peace from it.
One last question I wanted to ask you, Alexa. I have women who say to me, my husband wouldn't be like this if it weren't for the computer. It gave him easy access. And I know we're in a situation where it's a gay husband, but certainly it goes on with straight men also, that they become, you know, they're picking up people on the computer that they wouldn't really have access to necessarily before. So is it really the computer that has done this, or were people just having a means of doing it now? They would have been like this anyway.
I think there was something in them before that, or there was a predisposition. There was something that could have been encouraged or triggered, but the easy access to the computer could have, you know, escalated or gave them better access to it. But usually I think if it's, you know, if someone's going to do something, they're going to do it. Like I say sometimes when someone who's dead set on committing suicide, they can, without any warning signs, people say, is there anything I could have stopped them? When someone really wants to do something, they can do it. So I think if there's a will, they will do it. If this is something that's in them, that's something that's in them. We, you know, everyone can say, I could have done this, I could have done that. And I think it's really, you know, just take it. The other person has to take responsibility, the person who's acting it out, because it's their responsibility. They make their choices, no matter what's
right.
put in front of them. Everyone has a computer in front of them, and not everyone acts out and cheats over the Internet.
I think you're absolutely right, that if it's not in you to start with, you're not going to be looking for it, and it doesn't make you, you know, more gay or more of a cheat. You would be gay regardless. It's just gives you maybe some access for confirming it or doing things or meeting people, but that doesn't change your sexuality that was already defined, and you
mm-hmm.
just, you know, hadn't accepted it.
Yeah, I think
so,
there's definitely something was going on.
So I'd like to conclude tonight with this question. How do you make sure this doesn't happen again? Because I tell our women that if you don't build yourself up, that you will eventually meet some other predator who is going to take advantage of you. You may not have another gay husband, but you'll have somebody who's not worthy of you and who will try to manipulate you and use you once again. Is that correct?
Yes. I think it's exploring and healing from the betrayal of whatever of the relationship, and then really finding in a healthy way, not in a judgmental way, why you think you were kind of, you know, why this happened, why it was going on, what, you know, how did you feel about yourself, and exploring that, and then also keep, you know, figuring out what type of traits did this person have, what were you attracted to, what weren't you attracted to, and really exploring that, and then really listening to your gut and listening to your instinct. And I think a lot of women say, no, maybe not. If your gut and your instinct says go, leave, this isn't right, it's not right most of the time. I think your gut is people's guts, and we have to really listen to that inner voice in ourselves that says, you know, this isn't right, I shouldn't be treated like this. And to be able to set boundaries. And I know everyone wants to fall in love, everybody wants to be with someone, but I think it's make sure you're not compromising and not, you know, don't make someone out better than what they really are. Really get to know the person and let them reveal who they are, because in time they'll show it, or in the beginning they'll show you some signs of who they are. Just keep your eyes open. You can still enjoy it, but keep your eyes open.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being our guest tonight. I am always so wowed by you. And I just want to let people know that, you know, Alexa is in Westchester area of New York, but she also does phone counseling, so you never have to leave your home. You know, she also does private counseling by phone. So if you're interested, you can always write to me at bondk@AOL, and I'll forward your message to Alexa if you didn't have time to write down how to contact her. But you can also find her at Facebook under Insight to Healing.
Insight into Healing, yes.
Can they find you on Facebook, just on yourself?
I have it on private, because
okay.
But the whole therapy thing is I cannot have personal contact with clients, just like whole code of ethics and conflict of interest. But I have a Facebook page, Insight into Healing, and then I have an email, insightintohealing@gmail.com. I check all the time.
And I think you're better off with that, because until they would learn how to spell your name right, it took me like 6 months.
I know.
I'm so wasn't getting it right, but I think I have it down better now, right?
Yes, you have it down.
Am I doing better at it?
Yes, definitely.
That was my goal, to learn your correct name so I can tell people the right way, because I just love having you. I wish I were closer. I would really come there and visit you weekly myself. I mean, you can really resolve so many issues on so many levels for so many people, and that's what I love about you. But I will ask for a commitment that you come back again in a couple months.
Definitely, I would love to. I love coming on your show, definitely.
Thank you so much, Alexa, and I just love you, and I can't wait to meet you sometime, hopefully, in the next couple of months in New York.
Yes,
so
please,
I
want to
thank you again, thank all of our listeners, and we'll be back again with you here next week on Straight Wives Talk Show. Good night, everyone, and good night, Alexa.
Good night.
All right, bye-bye.